This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you all for coming. I know it's a very busy time of year. This paper, I feel I should explain a few things about it. My publisher, the University of Chicago Press, is going to bring out a book of my art essays, 15 years of art essays, in the coming year. And each of those essays is a particular study of an artist or of a work of art. And they wanted me to write an introduction. And at the same time, I've had a number of invitations in the last year and a half or so to write on aesthetics in general. So I decided to write a kind of working paper about aesthetics, and the most recent incarnation of that is a paper I gave about a month ago at Berkeley at the Center for Art Research there. So I'm going to read you that version of it. It's not that long. I'm really delighted that there's so many working artists here tonight, and I apologize, the paper is quite abstract, but I also really do consider it a working paper, and if you have, I hope you'll have some thoughts, suggestions, and criticisms to give me after I'm finished reading it. On the art of the future, the question I was and was asked to consider is, does the concept of art do useful work, or is it now primarily a defensive political gesture? The question suggests a separation between the concept and practice of art that I would like to take up and then reimagine in terms that separate the ongoing work of individual artists from the path of art as a whole. I assume the question raises the specter of a defensive political gesture because of the attack on art from within aesthetics, the death or end of art argument that we've inherited from Hegel, and the attack on art from without aesthetics, the ideological suspicion of art we've inherited from Plato, a suspicion that continues to underlie attacks on art from the standpoint of religion and the state. In an effort to address both the internal and external attacks on art, and to talk about a collective framework for the arts in what I hope are neither defensive nor merely political terms, this paper will be concerned with art's relation to ethics. The argument is rooted in the relation between aesthetics anesthesis, or sense apprehension, and in the deep formal analogy between the face-to-face encounter between persons and the face-to-face encounter with artworks. To put my aims simply, I am interested in preserving persons from totalitarian systems of social control, including systems of non-consensual time and technological development, and preserving artworks from speculative allegory. That's why there aren't any particular artworks in this paper. I believe that this task requires concepts of persons in art that strive toward the most general universality without a prior outcome in mind, hence a universality that precedes cultural choice-making. I imagine the ground for this pre-cultural choice-making to be nature, and by now a common concern for the future of nature. This concern is inseparable from our acknowledgement of finality of form in the world, and a concern with living things coterminous with our own finite being. I will suggest, following directly from Kant, that art is a domain for the exercise of non-teleological judgments, hence art's deep commitment to a practice that is truly a practice, and that such aesthetic judgments provide a non-teleological paradigm for the ongoing work of ethics. Here I would like to pursue a concept of art that addresses the real consequences of metaphysical beliefs for thought and perception, and that considers transformed conditions of thought and perception as occasions for transforming relations between persons. So let's follow Kant in saying that art is a practice for its own sake, and then ask what a practice for its own sake might be for. I believe that many of us who make and write about art have forgotten to ask such a question, because we have not been patient enough to separate the two strands of the following formulation. At one level, instances of art practice can be in themselves and for themselves. At another level, the long historical development of art can have consequences that are not dependent upon the outcomes of particular works in either their creation or reception. To continue to confuse the particular activities of artists with the broader function of art in the development of human culture is to ignore artworks in their specificity and to foreclose the possible work of art in general. If function is indeed met by this long historical trajectory, then individual works, as Kant surmised, need not themselves bear the burden of purpose. Such works would precede cultural understandings of purpose and not be in pursuit of them. I see no reason to presume art is a cultural production. That's my heresy. Such a presumption tends toward a representative function for art and masks the ways in which culture is itself an aesthetic production. Separating the situation of individual artworks from the history of art in general also means that the demand to reconcile theory and practice is unnecessary, perhaps even untenable. As any working artist knows, art practice that proceeds under the shadow of theory is doomed to be mere allegory. And as any working aesthetician knows, theories of art bound to particular historical practices are doomed to apologetics. Here I am merely recapitulating under other terms Kant's well-known axiom that concepts without percepts are empty, and percepts without concepts are blind. For art to be of any use at all to us, there must be a tension between the actual circumstances of perception and the continuity of conceptual habits. Art theory has demanded of us a reverence for such habits as things of the past, approaching a reverence for nature. And art theory has also rather paradoxically demanded of us an overthrowing of such habits, also as things of the past, a demand in the shadow of the planned obsolescence of commodity culture. Yet whether theory demands reverence or denigration, the result is the same, a declaration of the death of art. Jay Bernstein has suggested helpfully in this regard that philosophy's constantly renewed announcement of the death of art can be read as a response to art's unstated assertion by means of its animation of sense particulars of the limits of philosophy. We reach this fulcrum between the demands of art theory and art practice via another conceptual habit, the tendency when talking about aesthetics to conclude with productive tensions, necessary dialectics, or notions of interplay. Such a tendency seems to me to resolve the real tensions between sensual particulars and abstraction, as if thought were the sole sphere of aesthetic experience. Instead, I want to propose that what the practice of art in general might be for is the carrying forward of a practice of ethical encounters between persons, encounters that are in and for themselves. I say might be because I am viewing the history of art in a way that emphasizes such encounters, and I'm going to suggest that art offers a potential sanctuary, a secular sanctuary, for such encounters in the future. Such an ethics is by definition both hypothetical and incomplete, and yet perpetually realized under the finite circumstances of particular encounters, features it shares with aesthetics. I take very seriously here the outcomes of art as purposeless practice. This purposelessness is at the heart of what makes art a possible sanctuary. Far from removing art from the spheres of political power and importance, art's hypothetical and incomplete aspects are vital to both its conceptual freedom and its capacity to bear an ethical orientation. To say that art making is a practice indicates from the outset that the task of art is unfinished. Individual works will necessarily exhibit finality of form, but the task of art in general is incomplete. Something continues to call for art, something in the experience of those who make it, and something in the experience of those who seek to apprehend it. Nature produces beauty without human intervention, but not artworks, and no artwork can be completed without reception. Our metaphors for these recurring openings to art as a summons to apprehension, to call, to speak, to hear, or touch, reveal the etymology of aesthetics and sense experience that calls for intersubjective apprehension and the continuity between such experiences and face-to-face encounters with other persons. Aesthetic judgments and ethical choices take place as face-to-face experiences. Such encounters may involve the immediate presence of others, or they may involve a retrospective or projective imagining of such presence. The persistence of the face-to-face relation in the structure of aesthetics and ethics provides a deep and formal analogy. This similarity in form is why the relation between aesthetics and ethics cannot be reduced to the mere conveyance of ethical themes by works of art. Nor can pleasure and the sensuous apprehension of other persons be banished from ethics. Our meanings with artworks are embedded in the meanings and conventions we bring to encounters with other persons, and all non-monumental art is a means of figuration in this sense. Yet specifically, this meeting with an artwork that is in itself and for itself is analogous to that free ethical stance in which persons are encountered in themselves and for themselves without prior determination of outcome or goal. When we consider an artwork as something meant, it is the intentions and actions of individual persons that we seek to recover and come to understand in a project of implicit mutuality and heightened responsiveness or intensity. Face-to-face forms have a capacity to change or move us, perhaps because of their propinquity and because of the incipient tactility such close conditions imply. With such propinquity comes the possibility and hence the necessity for refusal of injurability. That refusal underlines the assumptions of ongoingness and reciprocity tacit to all face-to-face, first-person, and conversational encounters. We can separate ourselves conceptually and sensually from monumental and spectacular works of art, but the intimacy and affect of face-to-face works stems from our human scale and biological experience. Just as the absence of such a scale in our meetings with certain other phenomena, including some works of art, is the basis for our intuition of sublimity. But face-to-face communication is not sublime. It relies upon frontality and reversibility, involving frames of reciprocity that neither sublimity nor the conventional irreversible time system of social life can accommodate. Human facial expressions may be said to offer temporal depth rather than spatial limitlessness. Within a finite material frame, the human face can proffer an unlimited range of expressions, including impassivity, that both reveal and conceal meanings to a receiver, and that move between spontaneity and volition on the part of the maker. When considered in light of animal expression more generally, human expressions are unique in the range and complexity of meanings they produce. When we turn toward another's facial expressions, and when we perceive what is alive about another person, we encounter the simultaneous underdetermination and overdetermination characteristic of symbols more generally. Recent work on animal calls and other forms of acknowledgement indicates such calls and expressions are far less likely to be unbidden responses to pain than to be intended and intrasubjective. And recent work on facial agnosia, or an inability to remember and recognize faces, indicates that the way we recognize faces in general is separate from the way we recognize individual faces. From the presentation of the newborn as head first to the fixing of the death mask at the entrance to the acknowledgement of the face is inseparable from the claim to personhood, the person who inhabits space and undergoes time. Both the Greek and Latin indicate the individual living human countenance and the fixed visage of the mask at once, and so incorporate the living and contemplated forms of the face from the perspectives of bearer and beholder. The face is individual and unique, as well as the site of an indeterminate expression that is open to a universal intelligibility. This universality is based in nature, that is, in human nature, and is why such indeterminacy is open to interpretation and the disarchy of particulars to be received as the consequences of intention. Let's consider then some of the ways in which our apprehension of other persons in face-to-face encounters involving both individuation and indeterminacy is aligned to our apprehension of aesthetic objects. The critique of judgment offers a paradigm for aesthetic experience as an encounter between persons and forms and between persons and forms that is in truth an encounter between persons, the maker and the receiver. Though implied in the two analytics, this paradigm is most clearly laid out in sections 46 to 50 as part of the discussion of production and reception of artworks proper, rather than in the earlier discussion of the beautiful that emphasizes the beholding of natural phenomena. In sections 46 to 50, Kant holds that artistic genius cannot describe how it brings about its products, but rather gives an unanticipated rule to art, just as nature does on its own terms. That is, a rule that is inferred only retrospectively, and so a rule that requires the participation of another person, the person who receives the work. Kant further explains that though every artwork requires some purpose or intention in order to be art at all, this cannot be a teleological, such a purpose would not be adequate to the outcome of the artwork. Following Alexander Baumgarten's earlier writings on the complex and confused elements of aesthetic representation, Kant goes on to develop a theory of symbolization and overdetermination. Works of art present aesthetical ideas, which he describes as occasioning much thought without, however, any definite thought, that is, any concept of the understanding that is capable of being adequate to it. Here, every artwork confronts us with its form and with its existence as the outcome of a prior intention. Engaged with the work, we can only move backwards from its particulars to inferences of that intention. And those particulars cannot be readily absorbed within the concepts we already have in mind. They resist such integration, just as the artwork as a whole resists any prior determination we might bring to it. In apprehending the work, we do not diminish it or explain it away. We only continue to enrich our apprehension to challenge our usual habits of making the world intelligible. The individual, the unique, the indeterminate are adjectives describing both the face of the other and the work of art. Kant's aesthetics continually emphasizes the non-teleological encounter. We cannot decide before our engagement with particular artworks what they're for, what purpose or purposes they might or will serve. This emphasis on the non-teleological encounter readily can be compared to a similar emphasis in the controversial and often extreme ethics of Immanuel Levinas. Levinas describes ethics as first philosophy. By this he means ethics, not ontology, is prior, and particularly that ethics is prior to the legislating rules of morality. Using, in fact, Kant's terminology, Levinas describes morality as already overly interested in existing concepts and outcomes, such as those of property. In contrast to morality's predeterminations, ethics is characterized in this argument by disinterestedness, a form of vigilant passivity toward the face of the other. In an interview in 1986, Levinas summarized the basis of his ethics in the face-to-face as follows. The approach to the face is the most basic mode of responsibility. As such, the face of the other is verticality and uprightness. It spells a relation of rectitude. It is the other before death, looking through and exposing death. Secondly, the face of the other who asks me not to let him die alone, as if to do so were to become an accomplice in his death. Levinas' ethics of the face-to-face requires the perceiver to be held hostage to the requirements of the other, an extreme ethical demand that admits of and can be seen to compensate for the asymmetry between the relationship we bear to our own death and the death of others. It is only our own death that we will ever come to know, and whatever knowledge proffers will unfold literally in the end of intersubjective acknowledgement. Levinas himself famously rejects a notion of intersubjectivity, for he fears the narcissistic projection of our subjectivity onto the being of others, a projection that erases the particularity and indeed whatever is incommunicable in the existence of others. But I believe this position is also unnecessarily extreme, since we are able to recognize the common human position of others without projecting upon them the features of our own interiority. Just as the way we recognize faces in general is separate physiologically from the way we recognize particular faces. The extremity of Levinas' position in many ways recapitulates the sacrificial logic of the human relation to the gods, and indeed is rooted in a theology that envisions the human face as a vehicle for knowing the divine. Therefore, I would like to retrieve from his ethics a secular and intersubjective potential. Such an individuality must be an outcome of not merely the perception of particulars, but also of the recognition of temporal existence, a recognition of an ongoing interest that overflows the moment of apprehension. Individuality resists its own allegorization by the fact of death and by its structural and universal embeddedness in the temporality of intersubjective relations. We should remember that we cannot perceive our own three-dimensionality or what is alive about ourselves, and we cannot see our own faces. We continually require the affirmation of others to testify that we are living forms occupying space. There are then a number of links between Kant's aesthetics and Levinas's ethics. The non-teleological, the asymmetry inherent in reception, the imbalance between the underdetermination of received intention and the overdetermination of consequences, the requirement of an affirmation or recognition of being. But I must stop for a moment here and remark that what is equally striking is that Levinas's aesthetics and Kant's ethics are not at all useful for our purposes. In Levinas's most well-known statement on aesthetics, his essay, Reality and Its Shadow, he writes, "To say that an image is an idol or semblance of the existing is to affirm that every image is in the last analysis plastic and that every artwork is in the end a statue, a stoppage of time, or rather its delay behind itself." This is a strangely static account of visual art. This is not the audience to have to say that to. And he goes on to denigration of aesthetic form, claiming that only a reasoned criticism might restore art to meaning. And as Levinas's aesthetics here block any particularity or specificity of form, and so block our ability to recognize of which the work is an expression, Kant's ethics constantly turn away from particularity to the general rule, and they offer a hypothetical and universalized morality that is self-deluding, I believe, in its intention and ease of application. Nevertheless, Kant sets out, in his discussion of the beautiful as a symbol of morality, some of the structural relations between the beautiful and the moral, that both please without interest in the sense that moral interest does not precede judgment, that both involve freedom of imagination in the case of the beautiful, of the will in the case of the moral, that both link the subjective with the universal but without prior determination. What if we then took our cue from this structural analogy and proposed a particularly equally hypothetical ethics as practiced or modeled in aesthetic experience? Such an ethics would be volitional and reciprocal and would bind its responsibilities to the contingent particulars of the form in time and space. Art's full array of sensual resources makes it of more usefulness as a sphere of such hypothetical encounters than the discourse conventions of ordinary speech or action, which cannot accommodate the unsaid, the undone, or the merely imagined, and so limit us to realms of manifestation. I am suggesting, in other words, that we revise our usual sense of sublimation. It is life that might seek to be adequate to the capaciousness of our experiences of art. Following Levinas's first philosophy and Kant's version of the aesthetic encounter, such an ethics would be prior to the law and would provide preparation for conduct that ensures that it will not be based merely on either convention or the spontaneity of individual desire. Kant's ethics remain bound to the imperatives of pre-existing convention, but his aesthetics model a way of yoking our subjectivity to a universal disinterestedness that suspends its outcome. Thus, what remains of value for thinking of a Kantian aesthetics in relation to a Levinasian ethics are the requirements of disinterestedness and temporal commitment, a suspension of teleology, and ethical specificity. So long as those who make art have taken as their task the finer and finer articulation of pre-existing meanings, they have not been able truly to revise the possibilities of relations between persons. Artists have often decided to ornament or supplement such meanings, or they have merely inverted them in an attempt at transcendent values in the style of the avant-garde, and so such meanings have become petrified. Rilke, for one, was preoccupied with the limitations of art when its fear of external authority resulted in a compulsion to concretize. He wrote, "Fearful of the invisible tribunals of an oppressive faith, men had refuge in these visible forms, had escaped from the unknown to this concrete embodiment." For Rilke, the long development of plastic art followed a path of finding more and more concrete forms of realization and animation. Along this path, realism emerged as the accumulated history of conventions performing adequations of reality. Literally creating a life of their own, realist conventions were formed in the shadow of an absent and terrible figure who, omnipresent, prohibits its own figuration. But the consequences of realism's concreteness have been mixed. Realist technological innovations became redundant as early as the photograph, if not the perspective device. And this paradoxically redundant progress has not ended as we enter an era of various kinds of simulation of the human form. Labor-saving artistic devices, when applied to aims of realism, are sadly caught in a paradox of short-circuiting their own value, since they limit the possibilities of intention in making and of the inference of intention in reception. However, even when artists have limited themselves to repeating pre-existing meanings or merely made concrete the most familiar conventions of perception, artworks have also been apprehended as made things, as the intended creations of others, and so creations individuated and taken up in face-to-face relations. In this sense, art gradually has led the way in delivering the task of meaning into the sphere of individuals. As human culture has begun to turn from the sphere of moral law to the sphere of ethical choice-making, by the way, I wrote this before the Iraq War, so we're under the domain of the moral law again, I know, but this is my hopeful paper. Aesthetic experience has taken some responsibility for the task of anthropomorphization by which we represent ourselves to ourselves. Although realism, like various forms of narcissism, may be driven by desire for matching or mirroring, the face-to-face encounter with an artwork is an unfolding series of asymmetries. As there is a projection of the situation of the beholder or listener into the arrangements of the form, there is also an asymmetry between the particulars of the work and the assumptions or concepts brought to it from prior experiences of all kinds, including those of works of art. There is an asymmetry between the intentions of the maker and the consequences affected in the receiver. There is an asymmetry of volition to the extent that the free engagement of the maker is a constraint upon the voluntary passivity of the receiver, just as the active retrospection of the receiver reframes the intentions of the maker. Spatial asymmetry has its counterpart in belatedness in time. All works of art are destined to a belated reception, and more often than not, such works are gifts of the dead that have outlived their makers. At first, we may think of how this belatedness makes the face-to-face relation with the artwork merely a compensatory substitute for the encounter with living persons. Yet Levinas has described the ethical encounter, even when in the presence of the other, in analogous terms of belatedness. He describes how the relation with the other is time. It is an untotalizable diachrony in which one moment pursues another without ever being able to retrieve it, to catch up with it, or coincide with it. The non-simultaneous and non-present are my primary rapport with the other in time. This means that the other is forever beyond me, irreducible to the synchrony of the same, he writes. The temporality of the interhuman opens up the meaning of otherness and the otherness of meaning. The belatedness of this relation with the other is an opportunity to extend interpretation under the finite circumstances of ethical needs. In aesthetic experience, the receiver faces up to consequences as she infers the other's intention. In ethical experience, the receiver faces up to her own intention as she infers consequences. What is the result of these asymmetries, if not our abiding sense of the uniqueness of the position of the beholder and beheld? In his 1995 essays on alterity and transcendence, Levinas wrote that in representation, we have thought approaching even the uniqueness of the unique that is expressed in the face in the same way as visible in plastic forms. Uniqueness of the one of a kind, or uniqueness having broken with all kinds in the sense of the loved one being unique for the loves, a uniqueness that to the one who loves immediately means fear for the death of the loved one. Like language, artworks can make non-being present and so open up the sphere of being to what it is not, including non-simultaneity and time. But artworks are materially finite. Their aesthetical ideas are manifested within their finality of form, just as the fleetingness of facial expression is manifested within the finite frame of our mortality. Artworks and persons inhabit a materiality vulnerable to decay and disillusion. They require acts of physical care, as well as acts of disinterested engagement in order to continue, and they are finite nonetheless. They literally bear meaning, and once they are materially gone, they exist only if they are carried on in a paralife of reproduction and other forms of description. Their uniqueness can no longer be experienced without mediation. If the face-to-face, the volitional, and temporal asymmetry broadly link aesthetics and ethics as kinds of reflective judgment, then what are the particular consequences for an art practice that intends toward the other without seeking to totalize the representational field? Every gesture toward articulation is countered by the inevitability of disappearance. Within the realm of visual art, for example, to think only in terms of what has been made visible, or to go even more astray and think of visual representation as only based on what is available to sight, is to miss the long tradition of representing the invisible and the limits of vision by plastic means. As Levinas mentions, the notion that recognition has ethical priority over description is as well deeply tied to attitudes toward iconicity and the tension between iconophilism and iconoclasm. Whenever art makes visible, it does so by referring to the invisible from which the visible emerges. The unsaid can be withheld by the will. Silence is volitional and interstitial, a temporal aberration and an outcome of acts of attention. But the invisible, to which we can only refer by me, cannot be withheld and cannot be brought under attention. The invisible is the source of all visibility and never visible. This paradox is commensurate to the farthest poles of our seeing. At its most external limit, seeing cannot look at the sun that is its source, and at its most internal limit, seeing cannot look at its own mechanism. We cannot look at the sun, and we cannot look at our own eyes and faces. The sun is the source of all images, and at the same time, the most powerful source of iconoclasm. To try to see the sun or look at it sustainedly is to risk blindness. We seek a view of it through mediated glances, as we know our own eyes and faces only through the mediation of the responses of others. In the traditions of the Greeks, in many folkloric traditions, and in the Judeo-Christian scriptures, to look on the gods can cause disaster. Consequently, the encounter with the gods takes on the material qualities of the encounter with the sun. A surfeit of sensation results in deprivation. Here, in fact, we see the coherence of Arthur Danto's position that pop art signals the end of the project of concretization, following the contribution of the ready-made. For pop art presents the point of saturation for materiality, that moment when the concrete realist position finds its solipsistic end. In the context of religious belief, our view of ourselves is curtailed in comparison to the view the gods might have, and we anxiously establish and internalize our sense of what the divine view might be by adherence to perceptual habit. But in the context of a secular ethics, we might instead seek images that move between the iconoclastic power of the source of light and the impossibility of self-seeing. An iconoclasm that refuses to totalize the human image inevitably will be joined to a need to disseminate and multiply such images given the infinite variety of human forms. Otherwise, as in the theological turn of Levinas, we will once again mistake human making as something divine. Blockage accompanies vision. Deprivation is the partner of sensation. These truths lead me to argue that realism's domination of aesthetic theory has itself kept us from recognizing an equally powerful historical tendency toward iconoclasm, iconicity, and iconoclastic withdrawal from the sensory manifold. Following some of the arguments of Alain Besançon, we can recognize that the iconophile's attitudes toward optical plenitude and totality are invariably accompanied by specific gestures within the work, acknowledging the limits of representation and foregrounding the haunting of the visual field by forces of invisibility. In a secular context, foremost among these invisible forces might be light, wind, and time. Kant had characterized space as the realm of the external, just as he held that time is the dominant form of internal consciousness. It would be difficult to underestimate the great transformation modernism effected in our view of this spatial world. After modernism, the external became a source of abstraction, as it had been under Mosaic law and in Byzantine and Islamic art. No longer was the external world merely a trove of concrete particulars. Although this begins as a problem of visual art, abstraction in all the arts produces synesthesia. And because sight and hearing are senses across distance, synesthetic works linking touch to sight and hearing inevitably bring forward a correlation between proximity and aesthetic value. The movement toward abstraction, the breakup of surface into discrete material particulars, the simultaneous juxtaposition of otherwise non-simultaneous materials, the flattening of the picture plane and revival of an anamorphic relation to the viewer, the introduction of circumscribing outlines, the use of monochromism and borrowings of written symbols, the disruption of melodic or narrative expectations. When we think of these specific formal innovations of modernist art, we see the vivid influence of Byzantine art and its efforts both to avoid a totalizing presentation and to find, out of a love for the image that is tactually as well as visually proximate, a way to disseminate access to the divine. The icon maker borrows the abstraction of metaphor and at the same time uses the tactility of glinting and glittering and absorbent surfaces. His techniques express a refusal of perceptual illusion within a theology that rejects the material by showing its merely material status. These techniques are at once inseparable from the power of the glint in the living eye of the beholder, from the desire for animation, and from the experience of glimpsing and anthropomorphizing the sun, its glittering, glistening, and absorbent effects, its transformation of the edges and boundaries of entities, the repetitions evoked by the sun's after images, its facticity and abstraction at once. The modernist break with the concretization of realism continues as the art of our time begins to turn to new configurations of temporality and to countering any totalizing representation of the human figure. Such an emphasis on abstraction and invisibility transforms Kant's division between space and time. The figure of spatial orientation and location, who is the measure of spatial scale, becomes the figure of temporal existence, an inner experience that cannot be reified by conventions of single-point perspective, and who is revealed as a being of internal consciousness as well as external form. As modernism wrests the non-totalizability of representation from the gods and places it in the realm of external nature, the next great transformation in the ethics of aesthetic practice will be, I believe, an ethical acknowledgement of what cannot be totalized in the representation of other persons, and a recognition of indeterminacy in the encounter between makers and receivers. This approach to a general concept of art leaves a number of questions that I must leave unanswered. How in practice does the experience of specific artworks carry over into ethical decision-making? Are works of art based on spectatorship and voyeurism doomed to the absorption of persons into a priori systems? How is art making also productively counter to contingent nature and hence bound up with decisions about technology? For example, the conditions necessary for the practice of art by women have only been available by means of technological interventions in our biological destiny, of the kind artists like Arakawa and Madeline Ginz now imagine as antidotes to death itself, I think optimistically. Which raises a final question about art's relation to an alienating technological determinism and the absorptive social coordination of time. Can art continue to serve as an alternative to, and not merely negation of, such alienating forms? It is my hope that it will, and that it is by means of artistic practices and not merely through the refinement of aesthetic theory that this might happen. So thank you. So Erin, what do you want to have happen next? Okay, I need to be able to see people to do that. So bright. I don't know. I can see if I just come away from that bright light. Is that okay? Come out wherever I am. Right. That's okay. Yeah.
I guess several questions, and probably most of them have already been answered by your theory or even by the elaborations that have come before, or extensions that I cannot quite grasp, right? But one question would be, I wasn't sure about the reach of your concept of art, right? Because you seem to be speaking of art in general, fine arts, let's say, including maybe even literature, for example, while most of your examples actually came from visual arts, and there seemed to be a strong reference to in your paper to the situation of encounter of a person with a pain. In the sense that one of the characteristics of encountering a case of the face is a certain silence of the face right? And the face you were mentioning, I mean, when you were speaking about the specific of the face sounded like an almost silent face, right?
I'm sorry, what? Okay.
It sounded like a silent face, not mm-hmm. like the face of right. somebody who was speaking at the same time as gesture, right? Also, the connection that you made with the icon, which is and why seem to refer to this, seem to put in the center of your notion of art this particular mm-hmm. encounter with a face painted that can be the face or can be the absence of the face, but that still keeps some sort of relation with the. Mm-hmm. I had doubts about what was mm-hmm. the reach of your concept of art, because that seemed to be so much in the center, and then it was difficult to see where would you locate some cases that were problematic for kind of to like a texture or even normal, more in general. On the one hand, and on the side of time, really improvisation, let's say, where the position of the deferral is different, I would say, than the scheme. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this is a problem with the paper as it stands now, but I hope it's not a problem with the theory. Let me explain why. I mean, I think that the paper as it stands now may seem to be almost a paper about portraiture. But what I am interested in, and of course as a poet, my primary concern is with creating an aesthetics that can accommodate all forms of art, including the verbal and those forms made out of language. I want to think about, in an ethical sense, the relationship of proximity to injurability. So there's a certain kind of relationship to proximity that all art forms I'm addressing would be holding or under which it would come. But I don't necessarily think that it implies that only the sort of direct face-to-face encounter that you would find in painting, because our ethical relations with other persons includes their sensuous apprehension in all kinds of ways. I mean, even if, you know, I suppose we cannot walk through another person the way we walk through a work of architecture, but we may be offered a means of walking through something by another person in such a way that we can imagine their proximity to us and construct mutuality out of that. So I don't, and this is the part of the paper that is quite brief in this version about synesthesia, but I am interested in the synesthetic as well, and not necessarily separating out various kinds of media or genres of art in that regard. But I would say that probably you're right, that architecture is the least relevant aspect of this, although I know many architects who are very interested in thinking about architecture on the scale of the encounter between persons, rather than an encounter with something that is other, alien, or alienating, or monumental in some regard. The thing I think that's a more serious problem here is that I really do have nothing to say about monumental works of art, except for that we have a kind of sublime relation to them, and I've just put that aside. But I also think that probably is because I am a poet, and I have, you know, only limited experiences with certain works of art, and so I am very much interested in the way poetry recapitulates the face-to-face sense relation, and I just have finished a very long book about that, and this is a kind of afterthought to that book because I didn't really write about visual art. So I don't intend to give you a biographical or sort of textual answer to why I didn't talk about these things, because I really do want to develop a theory that can accommodate the largest domains of synesthesia and various art forms. Now, did I answer the second part of your question? I'm not sure.
I was interested in the centrality also in your presentation of the figure of the deferral.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, right. I'm sorry. Improvisation. Yes. Well, I think that the way that Levinas or I would
just one
sure.
One minute, think not only in terms of because in terms of musical improvisation, but I was thinking in the description of also sort of the situation of performance in medieval performance, right? Medieval poetry, where the poem is not disembedded from other dialogue, right? And then when there's a certain temporality coming into the poem, out of the poem, that doesn't seem to be characteristic of the situation in which the poem defined fixed, and then there's a very particular kind of distance between the author.
Well, this becomes a question about epistemology and how we're going to measure time, I think. I mean, you know, because I think it makes more sense to just assume a kind of relationship of call and response or summons and response that can be, you know, practiced by oneself if necessary. I mean, there's no need to atomize time into finer and finer increments or to make it seem impossible. But I am interested in works in being very conscious of the temporality of that experience, of this, that experience, like the temporality of sense experience, because there's so much pressure in contemporary culture, I think, in the coordinate of social time to speed up sense experience and to, in that sense, dismiss it, to make the social coordination have dominance over the sensual apprehension. So I don't think there's any... I mean, I can't think of an artwork that would be so simultaneous that it wouldn't, and still be apprehensible, that wouldn't involve belatedness. Okay. Bob, yeah.
I have a couple of maybe two large questions, but limits there were to what you meant by art. And I know at the beginning you said I'm not going to deal with specifics, I'm talking about the whole trajectory of art. And that made me, the first question I guess is that your sense of the totality of art is trajectory, is that the right, am I remembering the right word at the beginning? And you said not the specific artwork, but the entire my question is what is a limit to what contributes to that trajectory? Every empirical place and the ethics of encounter apply. Is every example of art equally art? I'm wondering where the centuries of polemic about values and right and wrong directions about art, do they apply to this theory at all? One place that I really came up was when you talked about the open-ended and non-teleological nature of art, but then certainly lots of examples. Examples of art seem very rote and fabricated and not need to be accidentally open, but not particularly intentional. So that's, I guess that's one question is what doesn't count as art?
Well, I'm a Kantian, as I think was evident in the paper. So what would not count as art would be forms made that were made under the conditions of determinative judgments. So works that were had a teleology that would be known at the outset. Now, let me finish my point, though, because I think, remember that Kant distinguishes between the experience of the beautiful and the production and reception of artworks per se. And what makes an artwork is that it lends an unanticipated rule to the production of some entity of this kind. And so, you know, I'm not interested in dismissing works of art from the past. I'm interested in reading works of art of the past as I would read any artwork, including those that are not yet made. And I'm also interested in thinking about what is the task before us now in making art. And one of the pleasures of writing this paper was to try and work through very seriously what I believe is the task of making art now, what is before us. And it's obviously, you know, complicated for me to say that it's non-teleological, because I think that there are various forms of madness in social life today that art might redress. But I'm also interested in doing that very structurally and formally, rather than redressing those aspects thematically. And the alteration of our relation to time and perhaps space seems to me to be the first task, one of the things that we might do.
One of the things, though, that seems to me about our apprehension of what is and isn't art, and maybe in that sense, I mean, is the way I, you know, my remedial basic understanding of Kant, the distinction between art and non-art. But doesn't it happen sometimes that art, as years go by and it's placed in the present, it's received in the present, that what seemed widely non-teleological, unpredictable art becomes seems more and more in hindsight to be recognized, that our perceptions of art certainly have a tremendous temporal perspective. Not that they always think the same thing, but would count something as, would even count something as art in any given decade or century, and that would change. So that's where it seems to me that issues of judgment and the judgment as the entire trajectory of art are at stake in our particular apprehensions. And I guess I'm trying to wonder, well, where is, you know, the boundary, not between a shape, the driftwood, as opposed to a koozie, and if I would call it a Kant example, but between Van Koozie and Lipschitz, or somebody like that. I mean, can the same kinds of judgments be applied within art, or is it just between art and what's way outside?
The distinction I'm making is so fundamental. I'm not talking about deciding which artists we like more than other artists, because that would be inseparable from loading on all the information that we would know about ourselves at a given moment and making that decision. But I'm interested in art as that which does not know where it's going. So, you know, when I have a list of things I need to go get at the grocery store and I check them off, that's a teleological process. But when I'm going to make an artwork, I don't want to have a list and check it off. I mean, okay. I'm sorry to make it such a simple example.
But when you look back at something and you say, okay, this is art that continues to not know, not be teleological. And this art, on the other hand, really just seems luminous.
Well, I'm kind of interested in looking ahead. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, I'm interested in what does it take to create a moment in culture when we look ahead and recognize our responsibility for making form, which includes forms of culture, in the same way that we look ahead when we're making an artwork, without, you know, in an unanticipated way. I mean, what if we take very fully that responsibility to do, you know, to proceed that way? Charlie Altieri, who was the person who organized this conference where I gave this paper, feels that this argument I'm making about ethics and the ethical dimension is just a Nietzschean argument, that, you know, we're responsible for creating ethics as we go, and we can't know what they are ahead of time. And to some extent, I think that's true. But there is, to my mind, something very valuable in Levinas's arguments about the finality of form, of our mortality, and the recognition of issues of mortality in durability, that I feel very poignantly right now because of the world situation. And the whole relationship between a technological form of death and a face-to-face form of death could never be more evident to us than it has been in the past few weeks. But again, I don't mean by face-to-face merely a portrait-like encounter or, you know, forms of representation that are only of the face. I'm talking about the face-to-face as a structural relation, a relation of proximity in general. We don't have to be thinking only in terms of conventions of realism as well. I feel that a lot of what we say about innovation and novelty in the art history has to do with the perpetuation of realist conventions, even when we're inverting them. And my attraction to Besançon's arguments about iconoclasm has to do with his opening up of representation to something beyond realist conventions, which I want to make, you know, I want to make a point that they are conventions. They are made things. There's no inherent relationship between realist conventions and their reference. And that might be another thing that would be confusing in the paper. But I don't have to answer all the questions. Other people here know more than I do about a lot of this, and we have something more to say.
I mean, I've been working before for 40 years, probably. In my country, when I was young, I used to do my own publication, my own poets. But I identify very much with what you say from the theoretical point of view, from the political point of view. My remarks vis-à-vis the possibilities that we as artists work on the world. I'm talking about painters, creation artists, culture. It's a reality which poets bypass. It is a reality that we work with problems of money, dealers, museums, curators. And I think that has an enormous impact on the future of art. Mm-hmm. And I see a polarization, which is evidently in the last probably 5 years, especially if you are working in the Biennale of Africa or Korea, and you are there and you see the reaction of the hardware curators, the last documenta. I mean, this polarization between entertainment and the probably the future, the vision that travel for the future. I think that one of the situations in Asia that will be probably important in the next few years is this relation between what can be an art of the spirit and an art of the market. I mean, it's very difficult for somebody working that work today to avoid the conflict and to avoid the confrontation that is going on, which is just going to Chelsea or going to see the sea. I'm talking not about, I'm talking about the art. Mm-hmm. It's the reality. $3 million production for a work of art, $5 million production. It's escaping the possibility of the intimacy that you are proposing in the paper. And it's a phenomenon which we are facing every day. And it's different from poetry.
Well, I understand what you're saying as well, including I will grant that poets are cheaper than visual artists. But to me, this is just I don't mean to minimize it, but it's another form of contingency. I mean, the scale of it is terrible, but compared to the other forms of contingency like death, I mean, in making art, we're always faced with the limits of contingency. So what is the realm of freedom that we can rest as artists away from the realm of contingency, from death down to technological determinism? So, I mean, we can't, and I think, I mean, I follow Bataille in thinking that if we simply invert or respond or negate those terms, then we will always be enslaved by them. That it's just another form of theology, that we continue to only respond or react rather than to lead the way. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, and I think it's just part, I know in my field, I mean, in literary theory and literary criticism and other forms of cultural criticism, there's a dominant culturalist model where we think of culture as determining art, but why not put it the other way? Because culture is a made thing, so why not take the responsibility for art coming first?
Yeah.
Right. Well, this is preaching to the choir, obviously, right? Yes. Right.
I think that
was
fascinating model
to
my love
model.
It's one of the ways of thinking about those things based on the
Well, it's the same in poetry, but it's not my stance or my aesthetics. You know, and one of the freedoms I have in doing this project is that I can promote my own aesthetics, obviously. And the artists that I have worked with and written about, particularly, and you know, are artists who've worked with these values in particular ways. I mean, I just will mention some of the particular studies that I've done. Anne Hamilton is an artist I've worked with a great deal, and Anne's work on the face-to-face and the sensual apprehension in particular is the heart of her work. Or Tacita Dean's work on coincidence interests me very much, and work on time. William Kentridge, William works with these, as I'm sure most of you know, but he always is working back through technology, through drawing, moving to outmoded modes of technology. And I mean, just peripherally, I'll say that I'm also interested in this in a gesture in the history of the novel, because I think that we, in thinking about the novel as being novel, we've ignored how many also novelists like Mary Shelley and George Eliot, Emily Bronte, also were interested in technologies that predated the moment of their writing, usually the generation or the generation before their birth. And this is something that Kentridge does. So there are lots of particular artists I think of. Thomas Schutte, Hans-Peter Feldman, these are some of the people I've written about. And I also, though, I'm very aware of the point Osvaldo's making, because, I mean, you can run the risk of becoming what a friend of mine calls an art whore. I mean, when you invest your time in writing about particular artists, then you also are investing value in their work, especially if you've been commissioned, as I often am, by major galleries or museum spaces to write about artworks. So it's, you know, I think it's a matter of constantly reminding or remembering the conditions under which one's working in a secondary or primary way. Jews, I'm sure you've thought about this.
Different kinds of things. I mean, I'm really excited about your looking at the future, of looking ahead with your formulations. And I think that in reference to your comment, that there was a time when irony wasn't there, and there will be a time that irony will, and it is, it's already happening, that the post-irony, which is such a hallmark of postmodernism, is just slipping down, and more non-ironic art is coming out, being validated, looked at, and so on. I guess my question is a very small one, which is, it may boil down to just how we use words and so on, because I think of modernism as a teleological pursuit and postmodernism as non-teleological. So how does that fit in with your using the word?
You mean because the teleology of modernism is to do what? To create
just a belief in an ultimate perfectibility.
Mm-hmm. A form, I see. Well, I mean, any stance one takes in this regard, and you know, if you're going to proceed by under a rubric of perfection or under a rubric of the unfinished or of the fragmented, there has to be, I think, some compelling problem or knot that's being worked through by addressing that. And of course, none of those things could be addressed singly. As soon as you are ironic, you are creating another form of sincerity, of course. Or you're saying that this is the dominant relation I have to time. I mean, a life dishes up plenty of irony. So I do think that irony is, you know, an important form of realism in that regard. But if we're going to overthrow perceptual habit, then working under a period rubric like, you know, I'm going to make paradigmatic postmodern art doesn't make much sense. I mean, you're a slave to some kind of critical paradigm. And why make art if you're going to do that? You can be a slave to critical paradigm in other ways that are cheaper.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
he's on record as introducing a Pascal's wager, in which he said, mm-hmm. well, I don't really believe in this mortality, mm-hmm. this issue that
we the death of art, right.
And we don't, his little point listening work was that, in fact, I don't really believe in this, but I have nothing to lose by ending my death.
Yeah.
If in fact they're wrong, I'm gone, but if they're right,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this to me seemed kind of like precisely the reading one should take in relation mm-hmm. to work. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, Pascal,
that's right.
And then the other thing was the city that they've been working towards constructing in Japan. In fact, it's a very totalizing framework in which, on the one hand, as you might argue, or from an Eastern standpoint, there is no ethics that's embedded in the city. It's one that kind of is improvised. There's no city center, there's no governmental authority, it's very baroque. But on the other hand, it's very totalizing, and they're master planning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what kind of a stance you would take.
I only believe that, I think Glaikov's essay on them is correct, that we individually are going to die, and they will die, sadly, as we will. But I don't mean that ironically. I also really do think that their efforts to alter our somatic apprehension of the world are very important. And I actually have recently gone back to reading Bateson again for a variety of reasons. And Bateson always said that. I mean, it has to do also with the idea that we, that there are acquired characteristics that might be inheritable, which is sort of an idea that you don't have to be a Lamarckian. And Michel Serres, for example, is a Lamarckian to that extent. And I find that idea very engaging. And I agree with Danto's position, the Pascalian aspect of accepting it, because you really don't have anything to lose, and you have a lot of work to do, a lot of very interesting work to do, if you want to follow that through. But I do want to make sure that I also clarify something, which is that in this analogy between aesthetics and ethics, the pressure here is that ethics cannot have the freedom of art. This is another reason why I don't agree with Charlie's saying that I'm taking a Nietzschean position, because ethics always are under the pressure of the finite. You must make an ethical choice. You have no choice in that regard. So in those situations of trauma or emergency or injuredness, art, I think, could be a mode of exit or a mode of practice, literally, just in the way that I think that Arakawa and Malinkins are trying to do. And maybe that also addresses your question about architecture to some degree, because they are creating an architecture. Another thing that interests me a great deal is the relation that gardens have to this other forms of altered traversal of space. And I did some work, of course, on Ian Hamilton Finley's garden in regard to this, but that's a different kind of garden in other ways. Well, there are works of art, of course, that are monumental. The model that I presented has to do with proximity and propinquity in a relation that would involve, the reception of facial expression, the reception of voice, the reception of touch. And monumental works cannot offer that. And so my work, this essay, is in a sense a critique of monumental art. But I also, I think that it's more complicated than that. I mean, even in Kant, the discussion of the pyramids involves moving the spectator back and forward, and the acknowledgement of the monumentality has to do with a kind of desire for proximity. And I think an artist like Richard Serra is, just a genius of this problem, because you can be overwhelmed by the sublimity of the torque ellipses, but you can also move through them and become completely absorbed in the particulars of their surfaces. But I think that this dynamic between abstraction and particularity can, to go back to Bob's question, also can be read in the history of art in its entirety. Because if you think about even the way that mannerist art produces this kind of vertigo of sense particulars, which is synonymous with abstraction in the end, in the way that abstraction of Sarah's type, or even the way the relation we might have to abstract expressionist painting, becomes more and more particular. So there's a kind of a valence or movement between abstraction and particularity. And maybe a more sophisticated version of this paper could accommodate monumentality's relationship to proximity in the same way. And you help me understand that, I think. I mean the speculative allegories of art. I mean, this is partly an artifact of writing a paper for a conference on the general theory of art. But my point would be that I don't want to create a theory of art that then can be a grid for making artworks. Right? I mean, I'm trying to create a theory of art. I'm trying to move the theory of art up until a point of openness where the task before us is to make the art, not that it's something that could be applied, and to do the kind of periodization typology that Judith was mentioning earlier.
I guess I was speculating not as a parallel between the two, but if you find ways to accommodate allegory in your set of ideas, you might find some ways to accommodate monumentality in some ideas as well.
Tell me how you're working at this. Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. I don't know.
I mean, there was some work by Paul de Man on allegory that made allegory seem like a symbol, you know, Kant's idea of the symbol as being overdetermined. I mean, and I think you can read anything that, I mean, you could read allegory against its allegorical imperative in that way. But I would have to think about, I mean, I think I have a kind of case bias against irony and allegory, maybe for the same reasons, because irony is too dependent on a retrospective correction, and allegory is too dependent on a proleptic expectation. So, you know, there's a trap there for me somehow, but maybe I'm not being open enough about it. I'll have to think about it.
But you're not, from what I hear in the paper, you're not for co-temporality.
No, because it's always belated. I mean, our relation to all temporality is belated in that way. I mean, so, but allegory is not, I mean, allegory, if anything, is not the, oh, but you're saying because of the two poles I just discussed.
Not
where.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, this is a great question, but it's going to take me a long time to talk about it. I think people are getting tired, probably. But if irony gives you one fix on the belatedness, and it doesn't open up the belatedness to indeterminacy. It says, click, this is what it is.
But so. I think you're selling, you're reifying irony.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, then, I mean, that's an idea of irony that it would be, that would make it, of the kind of aesthetic experience I'm talking about. So, but I think in Judith's example, it was a more limited function for irony.
Sort of a specific fashion job.
Get it,
well,
yeah.
And
yeah,
about
right.
Just feeling the coolness of the art room
Yes, thank you.
One could imagine an artist program producing work using the computer that was indeterminate, sort of open-ended in a way, so that maybe something produced using a random number generator, for example. Would you consider the result of this to not be art? Or if you would consider it to be art, who or what
you mean an experience would be completely random?
Well, for the sake of discussion, sure.
Okay, well, but see, for me, then it would be nature. I mean, it wouldn't be any to apprehend an entity like that that would be, you know, that would be that open to randomness and not be intended, would be, you know, would could necessarily, of course, produce forms of beauty, but I don't think that it would be an artwork in the same way as an artwork that is an intended artwork and that is the result of the consequences of a set of consequences of human decision making.
So at the moment that it's not random, then you would say, okay, then this now can be art.
Mm-hmm. I think that all forms of the imitation of chance in artworks are, you know, sort of hedging their bets or you know, operating under some form of pretense. It doesn't mean that the artworks aren't interesting, but the assumption that you are operating under a form of chance is an interesting kind of I don't know, security blanket, because the inescapable and universal forces of chance in our lives are so much greater and more powerful than whatever operation of chance we might be able to invent for ourselves. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, it is chance, but it's not, maybe it's a chance with a big C and a small C. Do you see what I'm saying? So I think that desire to create random patterns, or the beauty of random forms, is a desire to imitate nature. And of course beauty could ensue from that.
No, I would argue with that, because of course nature is rule governed. Mm-hmm. And the rules can be discovered and discerned visually and in other ways.
Well,
randomness is not natural.
I don't know whether nature is rule governed. I hope it is, but I don't know. You know, I think, I mean, that's a question about God. Well, we... This is so much fun. Thank you all for these great questions.
I'm sorry, but other people have a question. I'm not. I'm just like face to face. And I kept consistently, you know, counterexamples flood my mind. And what about face to face? What about, you know, many cases? Socially, not. Saturated art. I'm thinking of somebody like, say,
William Carlos Williams,
who's at his best, who's not just, you know, regular or photo voice, but is very much open to a very fluid and yet historically grounded confluence of social vectors. You know, in many cases, there's one. Spring at all when he's driving by and looking at a man who's half averted face is looking to the north, and a woman is laughing, and a child is looking at his watch chain, and the supreme importance of this nameless spectacle is I mean, to me, that's a great poem.
But I just want to clarify that would be a theme. I mean, that's the theme of the work. But I'm inferring that William Carlos Williams set that theme before me. I mean, I don't want, this is the answer I would give to you about the portraiture too. I mean, you're reading. You're when you're looking at any artwork, no matter what the theme is, I mean, you can, there are fantastic artworks that are the expression of crowds, but of course they're the expression of a crowd, you know, in a particular way by a particular set of intentions.
But so, with sorry. Williams or say Rivera, there's many artworks where, yes, the specific executor of the poem or the painting, you know, it's a person. Mm-hmm. But often what can be more interesting is how much openness to larger non-teleological social articulation is in there. So yes, Williams wrote that poem, but Williams the poet had been trying to be a poet in that fluid poet situation for years, and in some sense that New Jersey suburb was something to do with writing the poem as well. So it isn't just face to face with Williams, it is also more than face to one face.
It's just that I would say Williams brought that to us. I mean, there is a level of abstraction in this paper that can't address the particulars of perspective, say, in a work of art, which is one thing that you're talking about here. But I think all I'm trying to say is that even art, all of the works of art we have by that great artist Anonymous still involve the inference, retrospective inference of intention. We know that someone decided to do this instead of doing something else. And we are involved in that process, and that brings us into a face-to-face relation of the kind I'm speaking of. Not that it's a face-to-face relation of presence. I also want to clarify, I mean, because I've written a lot of stuff by now in my life, and my notion of the subject is not that, you know, that subjects reify themselves or present themselves when they're making artworks. We are socially constructed, but, you know, it's the same answer I'd give to Osvaldo. We're not socially constructed in every, you know, atom of our being. We are the history of our experiences, including those decisions we've made to make things or not make them. So when we talk about the social aspect of Williams, we're also talking about what it means for someone to present to us this a social aspect and how we can meet it. Sorry, Jen.
Mm-hmm. And there's lots of different intentions that go into the construction of an institution that, and I'm thinking about other institutions mm-hmm. like museums, but also like marriage and mm-hmm. family, which mm-hmm. you mentioned, and how those might play a role in your hopeful vision, mm-hmm. or is this an extra institutional kind of model that you're talking about?
It's a pre-institutional model, okay. I mean, but I hope that, I mean, that one would make institutions that would, you know, that would be humane. Well, you know, there are certain kinds of things you can do to a person at a distance that I don't think are the things that works of art would want to do. But, you know, I appear to be convinced otherwise by certain arguments that everyone's getting tired now. I think we don't have to make art tonight. We just think about it.
I mean, just to repeat what I said before, and being in my own argument, you know, there are always, in the art world, people who are saying always to artists of my time, artists of our time, there are always, there were some people who are not, like the other, who need the possibility to bypass. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is the hole, and this is the mm-hmm. way we operate.
Mm-hmm. A fissure for every pot, or whatever it is. A fissure in every oven.
They possibly change. After the bypass, many times, you have the mm-hmm. power to impose some other
yeah. thing. You never know who you meet in a fissure. It's true. Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you. Thank Aaron. Aaron's the art of the future.